I want you to think back for just a moment to David Sewell's reading from Genesis 28, and this verse. Then Jacob woke from his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." And he was afraid. And he said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." And then from the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 51, just a single verse. And Jesus said to Nathanael, "Very truly, I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Jacob and the ladder to heaven. There are four questions that we are going to have to answer if we're going to understand this story. First of all, what is so special about this Jacob, who we read about as he flees from Beersheba to Haran? Secondly, what's so special about this place where Jacob dreams of the ladder to heaven? Third, what is so special about what God has to say to Jacob? And finally, what effect does this encounter have on Jacob? So we begin with Jacob. You may have heard that the patriarch Jacob has described in various ways, and none of them very flattering. Usually people focus on his knack for deceit and trickery, his dishonesty. But you see, that's only part of the story and not the main thing. Jacob isn't in the first place a shyster. How would you describe Jacob? Well, to this point, Jacob has been a wrestler. He was, by very nature, a wrestler. He saw life as competition, and Jacob was intent on winning. He was born a wrestler, and I mean that literally. Already in utero, Mother Rebekah, Jacob and his unborn twin Esau had a wrestling match. Round one took place during childbirth, and in round one, Jacob did only manage second best. The best he could do was grab onto Esau's heel as Esau came kicking and screaming out into the world first. And with being born first, he won all the perks and privileges that came from primogeniture, of being the firstborn. Esau was entitled to a double portion of the inheritance and to a special end-of-life blessing from his father, Isaac. Both of these fell to Esau because he beat Jacob out of the birth canal. But that was just round one. Wrestler Jacob, although the weaker of the two, didn't quit just because he lost round one. Jacob began to rely upon his brains. And over the years, choosing his moments carefully, he managed to tweak this sibling rivalry to his favor. He finagled from brother Esau both the double portion of the inheritance as well as the old age blessing of his father. So if you were scoring round two of the wrestling match, Jacob was the clear winner. Now, as Genesis 28 opens, the wrestling match is about to enter round three. Father Isaac is nearing death, and the parental barrier against Jacob bashing is about to expire. Esau has even begun bragging about what he is going to do when old man Isaac kicks off. "I'm gonna kill that kid," he says. And Jacob only has to look down at his own puny biceps and compare them to Esau's field-tested and hunting-hardened muscles to figure out how round three was going to go. Jacob had won round two by tricking Esau into a bad bargain over a bowl of lentil stew. Aesop, as the bookies in Vegas had it, was the prohibitive favorite to win round three with an offering of knuckle sandwich. And so Jacob does what any intelligent wrestler will do. He runs. He hightails it out of there, heading for his uncle's ranch in Haran. And with it, his identity as a competitor takes a hit, and he finds himself that first night away from home in a space and a place where his very identity is in question. He no longer knows who he is, nor does he know where he is. Who is Jacob at this point? Well, he is the quintessential young adult, especially young male adult, of any species of any age, but especially of our day and age. You know, it's a fact of biology across the animal kingdom. What is the place of young adult males? I teach a segment in my environmental ethics class on the Asiatic lion of the Gir Forest in India. The entire world's population of Asiatic lions is squeezed into a small preserve in western India. There are far too many lions for the size of the preserve. As new lions are born, the excess population is forced to the edges and then to outside of the preserve. And who is this excess population? Well, young females get integrated into tribes. They belong. Young males, by contrast, are forced out of the preserve. They become loners, where they face daunting odds. Conflicts with humans, farmers, poisons, falling into water wells, poaching, struck and killed by trains or cars. It's a nasty, brutal, tough, and often short life. And sad to say, human culture oftentimes isn't that much different. Why did Islamic fundamentalism arise at the end of the last century? A major factor was the number of disaffected and displaced young men in Muslim society, looking for a place and an identity, a reason to exist. And they found it in jihad. And here in the U.S., the struggles of young adults, especially male, has been given a name. It's called adolescence. The lengthening of time between before young people assume adult responsibilities. Aimless, shiftless, unattached, a crisis of identity. Does that sound like Jacob? Jacob on the run has entered a new realm, the realm of the superfluous young male. And he doesn't know who he is, or when he is, or how to find his way out of this mess. So that first question, what's so special about Jacob in this story? Nothing. He's a nobody, adrift. The first step to resolving Jacob's lack of identity in his dislocation is to find out where he is. So our second question, what is so special about this place? Well, just as we said that really there's nothing special about Jacob that distinguishes him, so we have to say that the place where all this happens is no place. It is not only no place special, it is literally no place. All that is said is that it was between Beersheba and Haran. It is a deserted place, so devoid of comforts and amenities that the only thing available for a pillow is a rock. There is no sign of habitation, nothing identifiable, not even a name to tell him where he is. It's night. Jacob is abandoned. He is really and truly in nowhere land. Where is nowhere land? Well, it's the nothingness between places. It's a little like the gray and grungy days of February and March compared to the Christmas of December or the unfolding splendor of May. February, too, is a nowhere day, regardless of whether the groundhog sees a shadow or not. Nowhere land, it's like driving through North Dakota on your way to the Rocky Mountains. And see, here's the thing. The gods and goddesses of this world are the gods of specific places and specific times. They are for people who know where they are and what time it is, what needs to be done. So Pan is the god of woodlands, Diana the god of forests and hunting, the Canaanite god is the god of the thunderstorm. There are moon gods, and there are sun gods, and there are river gods, and there are highway gods. They all have a specific place and specific activities. Who is the god for nowhere land? And isn't nowhere land exactly the place where you really need a god? Who is the god for the dog days of August or the misery of February? Who is the god of nowhere North Dakota? Who is the god of no job, no purpose, no identity? As Walter Brueggemann points out, the remarkable point of this story is that nothing special Jacob finds himself in no place special, and God turns this place into a crucial place. In fact, and this is the key, it is in the nowhere of our lives where nothing seems to be going on, and we don't have the foggiest notion of who we are or where we are going, that God appears and turns nowhere into the house of God. And which of us doesn't find, at one time or another, find ourselves in nowhere in need of God? Our God is truly remarkable. Nowhere becomes somewhere. In fact, dare I say it, nowhere turns out to be the gateway to heaven. Which brings us to Jacob's dream and our third question. The first part of the dream is all action and no words. Jacob sees a stairway to heaven with angels ascending and descending. What you should picture is one of the pyramids of the ancient world, not the smooth ones of Egypt, but the ziggurats, the tiered pyramids. And up and down the steps of this pyramid, we find the messengers of God, angels going to and fro around the earth, carrying out the commands of God. This tells Jacob that God is still at work, and God's messengers are still at work in the world. And what is more, they enter the realm of this world in nowhere places, just as much as in somewhere places. God hasn't disappeared. Even away from home, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Sarah and Rebekah is still present and active. And God speaks to confirm this. God mentions the standard promises that had been given to Abraham and Sarah, to Isaac and Rebekah. God's promises hold true. This says, in nowhere, just as much as in somewhere. And what it tells Jacob is that there is still a land waiting for this figure in nowhere land. There are still children and grandchildren for this bachelor with no family. There will still come blessing to the world through this man who is feeling profoundly whipped and beaten. The standard promises still hold. But God adds a promise personal to Jacob. I will be with you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this place where you belong and where you need to be. Jacob, the wrestler can relax. It is not Jacob's competitive urges or skill at combat of wit that will bring him out on top. It's God's grace, not our competitive skills, that enable us to be winners in life. And the effect upon Jacob of all this is quite dramatic. Oh, he'll still be tempted to cheat in the future to get ahead. He'll still have his bad days. But now he knows that the God of his ancestors is with him, even in places that sport only rocks for pillows. And he exclaims, "Surely God is in this place, and I did not know it." And a deep fear of the Lord comes over him, so deep that it enables him to go years away from his homeland and from the things he had wanted, simply because God had promised to be with him. Jacob at Bethel. Nowhere man in nowhere land, as the Beatles sang. And in nowhere land, he finds a ladder to heaven and discovers that God is there, graciously there, turning nowhere into somewhere, a nobody into somebody, and the nightmare of the past into a vision of a gateway to heaven in the present. Now I want to make a leap here and give you in conclusion something to chew on in the coming week. In the New Testament, in John 1, Jesus promises his disciples that they will see great things. And he said, "Very truly, I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Kind of sounds like Jacob's dream, doesn't it? And it seems to me that here Jesus is making a startling claim. Jesus is claiming to be our Bethel, our house of God, our gateway to heaven. So that each one of us, at those times where you or I find nothing special about ourselves, and when we find ourselves in those nowhere places, that when we lie down in our dreary places where our pillows might as well be rocks for all the comfort they give us, at those very moments, Jesus is one place, our place, where the angels of God ascend and descend upon us, letting us know that this whole world is God's house. There is nowhere God is not present, and that God will be with us wherever we go. That wherever we are, there is a ladder to heaven. Amen. A carol. Now, I think most of us operate under the assumption that carols are for Christmas. But in the English tradition, there are Easter carols and there are other carols. And this is a carol from the 17th century that is about Jacob and Jacob's trap. We'll rise to sing this, and the choir is going to sing stanza one in the refrain. They'll also sing stanza two. We'll join on the refrain, and then we'll all be singing stanzas three and four.
Thank you.
Please be seated.